"Who is it?" the young man asks, peering out into the neglected garden where flowers and shrubs bend into strange shapes in the moonlight. "Let me in." She has a bewitching smile and a jar of his favourite rice wine. And he does, hesitant at first because he's supposed to be studying for the imperial examinations. Why is she alone outside this remote country villa? And why do her eyes gleam strangely in the rain-wet darkness? But he tells himself it's all right. She's likely a prostitute sent by his friends as a joke. They drink the wine, one thing leads to another, and despite her blushes and his untouched pile of books, he has one of the most enjoyable evenings he can recall. Except he can't really remember it. The details are misted in lamplight and laughter, but he must see her again. He seizes her hands, such long-fingered, sharp-nailed hands, and won't let her go. "My home is over there," she says, pointing at a curious little hill. "If you follow the road, it's the fourth house from the top." When I was a little girl, I read a lot of stories about them, and I was always wondering, like, what's going on with these creatures? Why do they always come in the night? And what do they want with humans? I made the mistake that many beginner writers do, and which is I put every single interesting idea I could possibly think of into that novel.
Hello, and welcome to History Through Fiction, the podcast. I'm your host, Colin Mustful, and today I am happy to be joined by Yangshi Chu, author of the novel The Fox Wife.
I think it's probably historical fiction and magical realism, because we're talking about creatures which may or may not exist, although they think they do.
Yangshi Chu is a New York Times best-selling novelist and a fourth-generation Malaysian of Chinese descent. After graduating from Harvard, she worked in various corporate jobs and had a briefcase while writing fiction on a coffee table at home in her spare time. Her debut novel, The Ghost Bride, was a New York Times bestseller and now a Netflix original series. Her second novel, The Night Tiger, was a Reese Witherspoon Book Club pick and a big Jubilee Reed selection for Queen Elizabeth II's Platinum Jubilee. She lives in California with her family and loves to eat and read. Today, I'll be talking with Yangshi about her new novel, The Fox Wife. Well, I want to start with the title, The Fox Wife, and the mythology of fox in East Asian culture. Can you tell me what that means?
It's so interesting because when I was a little girl, I was always fascinated by these stories of shape-shifting foxes. And that is, the fox in East Asia is a creature which is supposed to have supernatural abilities. It's able to turn into a charming person. That usually means a beautiful woman or a handsome man. But also being a fox, it's very tricky. And they're also supposed to steal qi, that is people's life force. So when I was a little girl, I read a lot of stories about them, and I was always wondering, like, what's going on with these creatures? Why do they always come in the night? And what do they want with humans? And it stayed in the back of my mind when I'd started on this novel, which is my third. I sat down and I wrote the first chapter, pretty much as you read it in the book. And it was actually very fun. The voice of the fox sort of carried me away.
And you set this novel in 1908 Manchuria. Your previous novels were set in Malaysia. Can you talk about some of the reasons for the setting that you chose for this novel?
Yes, it was dictated because Northeast China is the ancestral home of the fox cult. So I think the fox cult actually is a very ancient kind of worship of foxes. And it's probably has animistic roots. And from there spread on to Korea and Japan, this idea of foxes. But they were worshipped as part of the Wu Damen, which is the five kind of five great households. But to us, the five great households are a bit strange because they're foxes, the fox, the weasel, the rat, the hedgehog, and the snake. And these are creatures that I think normally one wouldn't think of as a god, but they are considered gods of wealth in as part of the folk religions of Northeast China. And until quite recently, I think you could still find quite a lot of fox shrines in the region. Sometimes they were hidden, you know, behind, like they might be a Buddhist temple, and behind the statue of the Buddha, there might be a very old, small statue of a fox to show that it was still being worshipped, although not openly. Because I think under communism, many of these folk religions were discouraged as superstition. But to get back to your point, sorry, why 1908 and why Manchuria? I had written two novels set in Malaysia, where I'm originally from, and I had thought about putting this in Malaysia again. And then I was constrained by the fact that we don't have any foxes, you know, so I thought, well, one of them could have got on a ship. I said, no, let's put it in Northeast China, where they occur naturally. And I think in choosing historical periods, I thought 1908 was a very interesting time. It was the last year of the Empress Dowager Cixi Taihou's life. So she died at the end of that year. And it is the waning days of the last imperial dynasty in China. After that, China was plunged into civil war, puppet governments, and warlords. And in Chinese literature, foxes and ghosts are considered omens and portents of chaos, usually when the dynasty changes. So it seemed like an interesting time. Northeast China was also very much disputed territory. Russia had interests in it. Russia has always wanted an ice-free deep harbor port, which features in the novel that's Dalian. And also Japan was taking territory as well. So very interesting area.
Yeah, it's a kind of a confluence of a lot of political and historical factors. But within all that, you have your characters. So can you talk about the characters you created to tell this story, from, you know, the fox, Snow, and the photographer and the detective, and how their lives all intertwine?
Yes. You know, so I've always loved detective novels. And it did strike me that, you know, the turn of the century was a time when the modern detective novel was emerging. Well, actually, to be honest, Chinese literature has a long tradition of detective novels. There's a reference to a judge, Bao Gong, in the series, and there are a series of stories featuring Bao Gong from Chinese literary history. And in Japan, around the turn of the century, like the Victorian era, they were really interested in Western-style detective novels, the same as said the Victorian era. So that seemed like a good time to introduce them. Besides which, I spent a lot of my childhood, you know, reading anthologies of the golden age of Victorian detectives. So I couldn't resist that. And that's how the detective entered this novel. But I really began with the fox, as you mentioned. You know, the first chapter appeared in her voice. And when I'm writing, I don't have an outline, I must confess. These things sometimes happen. And my husband always says, if you only had an outline, there'd be a lot less of this howling and rolling around the floor. But sometimes it just strikes you, and I wonder whether you feel this as well, Colin, as a writer, that a character emerges in your subconsciousness and sort of takes over and starts to tell you a story. And that was what happened for the fox wife, this character Snow appeared, and I thought, oh, there's this woman, and she says she's a fox, and should we believe her or not? And that's how the novel begins.
Well, I will say, when I'm writing a novel, I kind of enjoy learning, you know, kind of like reading the novel as I'm writing it, kind of finding out what happens. So I think I'm a little bit the same way as you in that sense. Can you talk about how you might define the genre here? Because you're mixing folklore and history and, you know, all kinds of elements together. Was it difficult to balance those elements? And is there a definition you would give to this genre?
Yes. I think it's probably historical fiction and magical realism, because we're talking about creatures which may or may not exist, although they think they do, as well as a detective novel. So all three of them, I do find that all of my novels seem to cross genres, which I discovered when I first started writing, maybe it wasn't the best idea, because it's hard for booksellers to decide, you know, which section does this book go into? But I think it would fit into any of them, and also probably general fiction as well.
But as you're writing, did you have to be conscious of those different genres, or are you more of a natural storyteller where, you know, mixing those elements just flowed easily for you?
Well, you've caught me. I'm a pantser, like, so mm-hmm. Well, instead of a plotter, I'm a pantser, and I just let the story sort of run away by itself. You know, as we were talking about earlier, the detective elements didn't come in until chapter two. I was all ready to write chapter two, and then the words "the detective" appeared on the page. I thought, ooh, this is turning into a detective novel. Let's see where it goes. And as you said, it's really fun to let the characters explore and take you to different places. That's when the novel seems to come to life, at least for me.
Can you talk about the treatment of women in China at this time and how you confront that in this novel?
Yeah, I'm afraid historically the treatment of women has not been good worldwide, you know, and especially in 1908, I think women were very much, if you were an upper class woman, you might not be starving, but you would be pretty much kept in the house. And if you're working, then it was also a brutally difficult time for women. One of the things that I touched on in the novel is foot binding. And foot binding was extremely prevalent in China. It's been around for a very long time, almost 1,000 years. And it wasn't only restricted to upper class women. Even middle class and some poor women also bound their daughters' feet in hopes that it would secure them a good husband. So there are stories and the historical records of women like shopkeepers, and even some peasant women going to work with bound feet because they thought that would give them a chance at a better life. So I did touch on that in the book. I thought it would be wrong to ignore it, and I had to give an explanation as to why the heroine can get around. I thought literally women were unable to leave the house. You could not run very far. You could not walk. The bound feet necessitated constantly taking care of them, like taking care of the bandages that tied them up. So that was one way, a physical shackle almost. And at the same time, there was the usual thing, which is women had a hard time making a living. You know, it was hard for them to survive by themselves. It was not easy at all.
Can you talk about your own background as a fourth generation Malaysian of Chinese descent and how that background contributes to your stories? And also maybe a little bit about the value of having these stories told in popular culture in, you know, Western society.
Yes. So my, as you mentioned, I'm ethnically Chinese, but my family has been in Malaysia for a long time. So I'm the fourth generation. And what's always struck me is that I think Asia and is full of myths and stories and legends of which the Western world is somewhat dimly aware of. And I realized, for example, like my second novel, The Night Tiger, was about We're tigers. People were like, what is that? So, and that is a Southeast Asian tale of a tiger who turns into a man. It's the, in some ways, the opposite of the werewolf, in which it's a man who puts on a wolf skin and runs around the village at night. The were-tiger is the exact opposite. It is a beast who puts on the skin of a human and comes at night to knock on your door and eat you in your house. So, yeah, super creepy. So I always thought that it's a wonderful metaphor for the ways in which we as humans are constantly trying to assess other people. Like, I imagine the old days, it'd be, you know, people didn't travel as much. So you might feel like this is a stranger from a, they say they're from the next mountain, but are they even human? So I think part of that, the cultural beliefs, the richness of that has certainly contributed to my writing. And there is just so much that, you know, and my first novel, The Ghost Bride, was about the marriage of the dead, in which the, you know, the daughter of an impoverished family is offered a marriage with the son of the richest family in town, except he's dead. So, by the way, my mother, my mum who reads my novels, she's like, these are just not very cheerful. But like I said, a very rich culture. The idea of the ghost marriage is actually still alive and well in China and in, and also in Southeast Asia, wherever there's an overseas Chinese community. Generally, it's the marriage between two dead people. So if Romeo and Juliet had been Chinese, you know, what the families, the Capulets and Montague, might have just married them afterwards and everyone would save face. So that's a way to do it. But it's just so fascinating. It's still continuing nowadays. And that brings us back to The Fox Wife, which is about foxes that look like people.
Well, speaking of your first novel, it, I believe it made you a New York Times bestseller. And that's pretty rare to have a debut do that well. But I also, I want to know more about how you came from your background at Harvard and in corporate America and then New York Times bestselling author. Like, how does that happen?
Oh, you know, it was a complete surprise and I'm very grateful for it. It is hard to make a living in the arts. I would say even now that, you know, sometimes I go and talk to high school students and I always tell them, you, if you want to be a writer or a sculptor or a musician, most all of us need day jobs. So I did spend a long time working a corporate job with a lot of finance spreadsheets. And I never really thought about becoming a writer. I think when I graduated from college, I was concerned, as most people are, about paying off my student loans. And I continued working for a long time, but I did write in my spare time. And I wrote a lot of rather bad short stories. I never thought I would be able to write a novel. And then one day I started writing, actually I spent 8 years writing a terrible novel about an elephant detective. And people would say things like, is this a children's book? And I'd be like, no, actually it's not. So it never went anywhere, but I'd like to encourage those of us who are out there writing that just keep writing, write what you like. I spent 8 years on it. It never went anywhere. It's still hidden in my drawer. But I think it helped me to write the next book, which is The Ghost Bride. And I found, as I've talked to other authors and writers, that everyone's path to publication is different. It's a very odd industry. There is no profile. You know, there have been people who, you know, I think, was it Frank McCourt? Or, you know, you're in your 60s by the time you publish your first novel. So there is no very clear path.
Well, and I can speak to that a little bit. You know, I'm an author and a publisher. My full-time job is the general manager of a pizza restaurant. So it's a completely different world, a completely different mindset, but it helps me pay the bills while I continue to pursue the arts.
Mm-hmm. I think that's so true. And I was talking to a young person quite recently. They were asking me, and they were in college, and they'd said, "What should I do if I want to be a writer? Should I even get a regular job?" And I said, "Yes, you should, because we all need to pay the bills." And not just that, I think working a regular job and observing the interactions of people, whether you had a good day, whether you had a bad day, whether someone came and had a huge tantrum at work, that's all interesting. You know, that is, I think, to write is to study human nature. And it's very hard to do that if you're locked away in a tower somewhere. Most of us have to go out and start shoveling things.
So you talked about the novel or the manuscript that you worked for 8 years on. Mm-hmm. Can you talk a little more about maybe some specific low points or obstacles along your journey? And then maybe some points where you were rewarded and you found that success that was so difficult to find.
Well, actually, to be honest, I still pinch myself some days. I pinch myself and think, wow, did someone actually ever publish this book? Good heavens. And that's why I'm so honored and grateful that anyone has picked up any of my books at all. And once again, Colin, thank you for having me on your podcast. But I did realize that with this, my Elephant Detective novel, I made the mistake that many beginner writers do, and which is I put every single interesting idea I could possibly think of into that novel. So I was like, so elements that went into The Ghost Bride went in there. So someone who was engaged to a dead man, yes. A detective with an elephant, yes. Multiple bodies found, yes. Circuses, it was set in a circus in Malaysia, because we had a lot of traveling circuses. Even through the 50s and 60s and 70s, you'd see them. They would come to town. It was very interesting. So it was just a massive, unwieldy book with too many. And then at one point I thought, I'm having a lot of trouble with my elephant as a detective, because I literally could not get him from one scene to another because there's like an elephant in the room. So I thought, this is too hard, you know? And so a low point came when I'd been working on it. It was a massive book. It was full of lots of random stories. When I was growing up, I also liked Rudyard Kipling as well as Agatha Christie. So amid the plethora of bodies that the traveling circus turned up, there were also lots and lots of animal stories. And I thought, this is just terrible. I wrote this, I cannot read it. So I think that was a low point. And also a point in which I think there's always that phrase, like, kill your darlings. And I thought, oh dear, I don't think anyone should read this book. So I put it away, you know, and that was 8 years of sort of, I mean, it was 8 years of working on something that just didn't go anywhere, but I do really feel that I'm grateful for it. I learned a lot of things, and I learned a lot of things that don't do stuff like have pages and pages description. I think that's always the issue with historical novels in particular. Do you ever feel like that? Because you have to bring your reader into a time, into an era that they're perhaps not very familiar with. But you want to avoid the, by the way, Bob, do you remember in 1879 when that Civil War broke out?
Yeah, I find that in first drafts that it's okay to do some info dumping, mm-hmm. And then kind of cut back as you go and find ways to turn those info dumps into scenes. But yeah, it's definitely an issue for historical writers, especially after doing so much research, you feel obligated to put it in there.
Yeah, absolutely. You're like, and then I discovered this interesting thing about outhouses, and then let's have an out, and then you're like, this is a really bad idea. So
yeah,
that's true.
At the beginning of our interview, you read an excerpt for us, and I commented on what a great job you did reading, and then you pointed out, well, I narrate my own audiobooks. Tell me how that came about and some of the challenges in learning how to do that kind of voice acting for your novels.
Well, thank you. I love reading audiobooks. I didn't realize, well, let me back up to... At first, I was actually unaware that there would be an audiobook at all. You know, that's how clueless I was. So my publisher said, By the way, there will be an audiobook. This is for my first novel, The Ghost Bride. And I thought, oh, that's so interesting. And then I thought, oh, if they're having an audiobook, could I please audition to read it? Because it's set in Malaysia. And Malaysia, as you might know, is a multicultural country. So they're Malays, they're Chinese, they're Indians. We speak a lot of dialects. Within Chinese alone, there's a lot of Chinese dialects. And there were many local terms. So I was worried that they would be mispronounced. And I also thought, nobody's going to read this book. Just maybe my mum and her hairdresser, they might each buy two copies. So can I please read this? And so my publisher had been like, do you have any experience reading? I was like, no. And they were like, I said, could you at least give me a tryout? And they said, okay, fine. You know, you can come by and we'll give you a studio tryout. And they very kindly did. I'm really glad they gave me that chance. So I did a little try it and they said, okay, fine, you can read it. And it was very exciting in the sense of I had never done any professional reading, but I have been reading all these years to my children at night. So we read lots of kids' books as well as Lord of the Rings. And what I hadn't realized is that for adult novels, you don't actually have to make voices. But for my first two novels, I thought, it's like after reading Roald Dahl, you think, I need to make a voice with the mouse. Later on, when I was doing the audio for The Ghost Bride, at one point, we were in the studio, and the producer suddenly, she said, it's so nice that you're making voices because most adult readers don't. And I was like, really? That was an option. So it's challenging. At one point, I also thought, like, who's the person who wrote this book? Why are there so many people? I was like, oh, my goodness, that was me. So it was a challenge. It was fun. I am very grateful to have been given the opportunity to read my novels. And so far, I've read all three of them, including The Ghost Bride. The Fox Wife, which we just wrapped up at the end of last year, and I think is now available as an audiobook as well.
I'm curious, do you have a hard time keeping the voices straight? Like, if you read a voice on page 35 and it doesn't show up for another 75 pages, do you have any trouble like making sure that it's the same as it was before? How do you do that?
Now, that's a very good point. And actually, I have to say that for The Fox Wife, I by then decided that I wasn't going to do so many voices because it was just really hard. But for the other ones, what happens in the studio is that the sound engineer will often take a little clip for you. So it's super helpful. They'll say, this is so-and-so. And they'll tape like, you know, they'll cut out a little bit. This is the voice of the old guy from page 10, you know, and then when the old guy comes back again, then they'll play it for you. Like, this is what he sounded like last time. So that's very, very helpful.
So we also talked about you're very busy with the release of The Fox Wife. Are you working on something new or what are your what are you planning moving forward?
Well, I we're always supposed to be working on the next novel. Right, Colin. But I am a very slow writer. I am working on my fourth book. And it's about, I'm not really clear about what it's about, which is sort of a dreadful thing to say. But I think it's going to be about ginseng, about the plant and the root, which actually looks like a human. I know my husband was like, why are you writing about this does not sound exciting. But I thought there are so many Asian legends as well about ginseng, including the one about changelings, you know, a child that looks like a ginseng root. So that's what I'm exploring right now. But I must confess to you, and please don't tell my agent, I haven't gone very far with it. So we'll see how it turns out.
Have they given you any kind of a deadline or you just work at your own pace?
I do have a deadline and I actually went over it. Then I had to go and beg them, like, please, please, please. So, so I really should do something about that soon. But it's hard, as you mentioned, when there's a book launch and I'll be going on a book tour, which is always fun because it's really nice to meet, fellow book lovers, people who like to read.
Well, Yangtze, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Congratulations on The Fox Wife and all your success as an author. And thanks so much for joining me.
Thank you very much, Colin, for having me. It was my pleasure. By the way, my mother, my mum who reads my novels, she's like, "These are just not very cheerful."